time for hour number two of the Bible study. Got some unfinished business, perhaps, that you'd like to carry over here on the book of Jude, our conversation with Pastor Bukowski. Or if you want to go in another direction, you're welcome to do that. Number is 505-7850, or toll-free if you're calling from someplace like Seward, Nebraska, 1-800-730-2727. Our guest is Dr. Paul Holtorf. He's a professor at Concordia University in Seward, Nebraska. Good morning, doctor. How's everything in your neck of the woods?
Hot and humid.
Hot and humid.
Yes.
Well, you got nothing on us. We're in that same fiery furnace here.
Mm-hmm.
And the term is over, obviously, at Seward. Is there a summer school?
There are some courses taking place right now online. We had a three-week summer session in May following our second semester. So some students took advantage of that. But for the most part, things are sort of in a slower down mode right now for most of us.
I want to take up an issue with you here that I think you as an educator, even though your students are out of the house now and not necessarily living with mom and dad, we were just chatting about some biblical text somewhere along the way here in the last couple of weeks, and the conversation found its way over in the direction of parenting, and the guest pastor that day, I don't recall who it was, kind of made a comment that if parents would stop trying to be their kids' buddies and would go back to the business of parenting like they should, we would see some improvement in some areas. Now, I heard you chuckle there a little bit. What were you thinking when I said that?
Well, I agree. I'm not sure where you want to go with that, but I certainly agree with that person's perspective on parenting today.
Well, the reason I bring it up is because we have a story that came out yesterday that comes out of Washington, D.C. The headline is Parental Rights Amendment Introduced in the United States Senate. Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina recently introduced a parental rights amendment calling for parental rights to be explicitly protected in the Constitution as a fundamental and not just an implied right. Designated Senate Joint Resolution 16, the proposal is a companion bill to House Joint Resolution 42, introduced by Representative Pete Hoekstra on March 31st of this year, which would prevent international law from interfering with state laws on families and children. DeMint explains, now we're finding that parental rights are being attacked by courts all over the country. And as we look at where this country is going, particularly regarding more association with the United Nations and consideration of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, these treaties would supersede all the laws in 50 states. Do you think he's overreacting, or do you think he's pretty much right on?
I think he's right on. I think it's very forward-thinking on his part.
When you arrive at that conclusion, does your experience as a college professor dealing with college-age students inform your position?
Maybe not so much as a college professor, but just as an observer of our current events, as anyone else is observing. And I do wonder whether or not the United States constitutional rights will be superseded by international law. And so maybe not so much from a college professor standpoint, but certainly just an observer. I think there's some merit to what this senator is bringing up, and certainly needs to be discussed at the very least at the national level.
Well, in a nutshell, I mean, I feel like I kind of struck a nerve here with you as you observe parenting here in the 21st century. Can you identify a couple of things that you think have gone wrong?
Well, I will go back to, you said a pastor had commented on that earlier. I think one of the things that has went wrong is the parents wanting to become the friend of their son or daughter and not the parent. The parent going out of his or her way to any length to want to be liked, to want to be their friend. And not to say you can't be a friend as a father or a mother, But at the same time, there's an issue of establishing boundaries, discipline, and just the whole structure of the family that needs to all be kept in front of the child at all times. And so I really can't think of a second one, but the first one really comes to mind as the one that I see most obvious today.
So as you are dealing with college students, and you know that sometime in the next 5 to 10 years, most of them are going to be parents, are you worried for them? Are you motivated to look for some changes so that perhaps they will not continue the trend?
Well, I always try to see the optimistic side to this thing with students coming through Concordia. I don't know for a fact, but I wonder if most students, when they leave this place, don't want to be different and change that's the way they were brought up. So if mom and dad were not allowing them to really grow up to be a man or a woman, but still to be a child in the presence of the parent, I would see the Concordia student wanting to change that and again kind of go back to maybe the way grandma and grandpa raised them or looked at them, establishing boundaries, establishing a sense of respect, understanding there's authority, but at the same time knowing that all of those things in place, there still can be expressions of love, expressions of kindness shared in that relationship. So I think parents, the future parents of 5-10 years down the road probably will go back to the way they saw it maybe modeled in the generation previous to their own parents.
Now you have kids, right?
Correct.
Yeah, how old are your kids?
12 and 8.
12 and 8. So you're pretty much right in the middle of the deal.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that you are interacting with parents at your peer level.
True.
Your kids are in school. Are you going to basketball games or piano recitals? And are you saying to yourself, oh, no, there's another bad example of parenting. You know, come on, get your act together. It's not that tough.
Are you talking about me?
I could be. I don't know. I hope not.
Well, you know, I don't know if I just have the blinders on, but I see at least the parents we do community things with, music, athletics, community functions. I see a pretty healthy balance. Now, once in a while, there'll be the parent that is, you know, obsessing and hovering over the child in every step, but that tends to be the exception and not the norm. I tend to see this though in college students and those students who are maybe struggling a little bit or having to make their own decisions, and rather than the parent coming in and saying, you know what, you're in college now, this is time for you to make these decisions about your classes or, you know, social things here. I think the students who struggle tend to also have the parents who want to make those decisions for that student. But typically that's an exception and not the norm.
Well, you know, there is a pendulum in culture, and I think it's probably true that the pendulum has been swinging in a direction that hasn't been in the direction of healthy parenting.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's on the verge of swinging back or has already begun to swing back, or are you predicting a long, dry period here?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, my experience level is somewhat limited only to one university and a community of about 6,000. I'm not sure if it's swinging back, but I am getting a sense from students that they don't want to go through the experience they typically had with their parents. And meaning that they want to change. They don't want to helicopter mom and dad over them constantly. They want to adopt a model that is more of roles defined, kind of family experience. The roles defined for the father, roles defined for the mother, an establishment of a sense of authority and a sense of boundaries. I think students that typically are desiring that sense of where's the line, and I think that's where they would see as their goal to do that for themselves in 5-10 years when they become parents.
The parental rights amendment that we're talking about here basically has three sections. Section one says the liberty of parents to direct the upbringing and education of their children is a fundamental right.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see any problems there, do you?
No, not at all.
What if the parents want to hold to a moral view that condemns homosexual behavior? Or what if the parents have a view that they don't want their sixth graders to have condoms?
Mm-hmm.
I see a problem not too far up ahead.
Well, and maybe now's the time to have that debate. And then I think that bill would push that debate along, that ultimately until that child reaches legal age, that child is a part of the parental supervision. And I think maybe this bill is going to push that debate along. And let's put it out there for the whole nation to see, observe, and contribute to. Because I am concerned that international law starts to take over a national law. And what was implied as a parental right has been taken away. You can look at the abortion debate and issue and how that has progressed legislatively and see exactly where the parental right has been diminished to some degree. And so I think this bill needs to go forward just for the fact of putting it out for the nation to discuss.
Section 2 says, and this is vague to me, neither the United States nor any state shall infringe upon this right, that right being the upbringing and education of the children, without demonstrating that its governmental interest, as applied to the person, is of the highest order and not otherwise served. Is that kind of confusing to you?
Well, I'm wondering if the intent there is to again to put the burden of proof upon the government and not the burden of proof upon the family. Whether it be health issues that the government deems absolutely necessary, let the proof of that be upon the government and not the parent to have to defend themselves against the government. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, but it seems to me to be problematic when the government says
true.
65 miles per hour and not a mile more, then when you exceed that, the government is in a position to punish you. It seems it's much more difficult to ask the government to aim high so that if the governmental interest is invoked, it has to be invoked in such a way that, as applied to the person, it's of the highest order. What does that mean?
Well, I'm a little sketchy on the details here, but was there not an issue a few months back, maybe a year or so ago, back when in Texas the government was almost mandating that every girl be vaccinated with a particular kind of shot to prevent various
forms of that debate.
Cancer. I think for me that would be the issue where the government has to absolutely show that it is in the interest of the child. Rather than the parent having to defend themselves, now wait a minute, do we not have a choice in this matter? I guess that would I would see that coming into play.
Section 3 says no treaty may be adopted, nor shall any source of international law be employed to supersede, modify, interpret, or apply to the rights guaranteed by this article. And that section is just designed to head off the force of law that seems to be coming from the United Nations and, to a certain extent, I guess, Western Europe,
mm-hmm.
Where things like the Child Rights Bill of Rights has become popular.
Mm-hmm. And I think the last two articles there are probably dealing with health issues that... Again, the proof of the importance of it has to come from the government and not from the parents defending themselves or choosing to opt out of that. And so I I think articles 2 and 3 are kind of this veiled attempt to get at some health kinds of issues that typically couldn't get could get passed in the United States without some other kind of government intervention.
The website here, parentalrights.org, says 3 major developments, all of them ominous, have occurred in the last several days. On June 1 and 2, Georgetown University Law School hosted a 2-day symposium titled The Convention on the Rights of the Child, Why It's Time to Ratify. This well-funded conference was held to organize a new coalition effort by American internationalists to seek ratification of the UN Child's Rights Treaty. Then in the second week of June, a major study was released by the British Education Ministry calling for dramatically dangerous increases in the regulation of homeschoolers in that nation. This study concludes that the UNCRC requires that the government enter every homeschooling home and privately interview each homeschooling child to determine, quote, if the child's wishes, unquote, regarding his or her education. And then number 3, on June 17th at the UN headquarters in Geneva, the UN Human Rights Committee, which oversees all human rights treaties, announced that it was forming a committee to draft a new protocol for the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. Under this new addition to the CRC, individual children would be able to file a formal legal complaint if they believe that their rights had been violated. It would give this new international tribunal the right to determine if the child's treaty rights had been violated by any person. Any of that putting the fear of God into you there, Doctor?
Well, I'm not so sure if it's putting the fear of God in me, but I think what it's doing is it's certainly signaling the necessity of having a Bill of Rights or a parental set of rights within the United States Constitution to make sure that we are not guided by international law, but guided by the Constitution and what's established in the United States. I mean, to the average person on the street, I doubt if they're even aware of this happening. But, you know, applause to the senator for putting this bill ahead of the people to understand that these are very real possibilities. Anytime there are conferences, international or otherwise, about these kinds of issues, you can pretty well guarantee that this is going to find traction and a way into the establishment of law internationally. And to be able to be ahead of the game and to say no, what is going to be established as the parental set of rights in the United States, that needs to be set. So when this does take place internationally, we have a foundation to stand on parentally in the United States.
So does the Fourth Commandment apply here?
Sure does. It sure does.
How does it apply?
Well, you know, anytime you talk about parental rights, you know, Dr. Luther also included that to include authorities as well, and authority means government. At the same time, the authority of government and parent were never pitted against each other, and I think that's the troublesome thing today, that it's parents against government as opposed to parents and government working together for the sake of the child. I, again, sociologically, 40, 50 years ago, I think one could make the case that, you know, all institutions had the well-being of the child in mind. They were all working on the same page. Parents were encouraging of the teachers. The teachers were wanting the best for the kids. And what has happened now is there's almost like this parental antagonism against the government and government's antagonism against the parents. And that really strains the understanding of Luther's explanation of the Fourth Commandment there, because the really intent was never to pit the two against each other, but to have both of them work together.
Well, I don't have my catechism laying here in front of me, but can you tell us what Luther's explanation of the Fourth Commandment is?
Well, you know, the reflection starts off with the parents itself, you know, in terms of fearing and loving God, and again, as that extends into the family, it certainly, first of all, deals with the parents, But then he also includes things of others' authorities and in honoring them and serving and obeying them, loving and cherishing them. And I think that needs to be kept in mind, that when we talk about fathers and mothers, we're also, you know, extending that out in our understanding in terms of governments as well. Luther's intent, knowing his understanding of how the government or the left-hand kingdom was to operate alongside and with the right-hand kingdom of the church, I don't think he ever saw it as one against the other. But I think what has happened in our society is that government has viewed with a suspicious eye the parental role, the family role. And likewise, I think the family has viewed with a suspicious eye the government's intervention in the family. And that becomes a very tricky thing when he encourages us to honor our authorities, to serve them, obey them, love and cherish them. That becomes a very difficult task as a Christian then.
Luther's explanation of the fourth commandment is, we should fear and love God so that we do not despise or anger our parents and other authorities, but honor them, serve and obey them, love and cherish them. What would you say to the person who says, no, it says honor your father and mother. It does not say honor your father and mother and other authorities. So by what logic does Luther extrapolate father and mother to other authorities?
Well, in a vocational sense, Luther, I believe, would have seen the extension of the left-hand kingdom, which would be the government or the authority mentioned there in the commandment, as a way of what's supporting the boundaries established for good order and for the sake of civil society. And so I don't think you can eliminate or have one and not the other in that understanding. You just can't have just parents and not authorities, when really the establishment vocationally of parents is to do the work that also the government is called to do, and that is establish the boundaries of a civil and respectful society.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Hi, Jim, you're on the Bible study.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I think what we have to realize is that we have to think about, you know, does the government exist for the sake of the people, or do the people exist for the sake of the government? And the more power we give to the government, the more we are saying we exist for the sake of the government.
Mm-hmm.
It's a dangerous path to go down, especially, you know, as a republic that we have established by rule of law. And so I just think that certainly the representative's notion that we have to have a parents' rights bill is certainly forward-thinking. And I would certainly support something like that.
All right. Let's take a break here. Thank you, Jim, for the call. We appreciate it. Numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Talking with Dr. Paul Holtorf this morning from Concordia University in Seward, Nebraska, and we'll be right back.
Your name is Jonathan and your father is the king of Israel. You expect to be the next king, but then someone else by the name of David is chosen instead. How would you react? On the next Law and Gospel, we will look at Jonathan's response with special attention as to what difference it makes in your life.
Listen to Law and Gospel weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on AM 850 KFUO.
During KFUO's 85th anniversary year, we encourage your congregation to become a Church of the Week. Your church will not only be supporting the ministry of AM 850 KFUO, but you will have opportunities to tell our listeners about your congregation and ministry. Your pastor or congregational spokesperson will be featured on the morning show, and each day your church will have 5 30-second on-air announcements, plus mentions every hour throughout the week. Please call us and become a KFUO Church of the Week.
Ancient man was just as complex and intelligent as humans today. Learn more about them on today's Creation Moments. And now, here's our Creation Moments host, Ian Taylor.
Cy Zan Han Ho was a 19th century Winnebago chief. A portrait of him painted in the last century shows him posing proudly with a stick in his hand. That stick is now at Michigan's Cranbrook Institute of Science, where its carved markings have been under study. The carvings on the 4.5-foot stick are now known to be a record of the waxing and waning of the moon over a 2-year period. Scientists have learned that Winnebago astronomers knew that the number of days in a lunar year turned out to be 11 days shorter than in the solar year. And they knew this even before they ever saw the white man's calendar. To correct their lunar calendar so that it would match the solar calendar, the Winnebagos added an extra month every 3 years. As sophisticated as this calendar is, its structure shows that it is related to prehistoric calendars of the Mayas, Incas, and in some of the ancient Siberian cultures. Man's need to measure time, which predates other written records, shows that man is very different from the animals. The accurate and sophisticated calendars of the ancients deliver a fatal blow to those who picture ancient man as a simple, unintelligent brute who was halfway between animal and modern man. And this higher view of man fits perfectly with what the Bible tells us about man.
To get a complete set of transcripts from Creation Moments programs, ask about the book Letting God Create Your Day when you visit us online at creationmoments.com or give us a call at 1-800-42-BIBLE and join us again for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
I'm Diane.
I'm Roland.
On the next afternoon show, 3 to 6 on AM 850 KFUO.
It is too hot to go outside. Stay inside, listen to the afternoon show. We've got James Dellingpole. He wrote the book, Welcome to Obama Land. I've seen your future, and it does not work. How do you like that?
Yeah. Well, I liked Obama and his little fly act there.
That little ninja thing he did?
Get some flies. Help me. We'll explore
Splat.
Obama Land on the next afternoon show.
Bring the family to where the mighty Mississippi and the Illinois Rivers meet in Grafton at the annual Great Rivers Towboat Festival, Saturday and Sunday, June 27th and 28th. Enjoy a little music, a little bit of barbecue, crawfish boil, and a whole lot of fun touring a working towboat and experiencing life on the Mississippi River. It's happening in Grafton, Saturday and Sunday, June 27th and 28th. It's the Great Rivers Towboat Festival happening in Grafton.
This is the Bible Study, the Ask the Pastor Hour of the Bible Study. Dr. Paul Holtorf is with us today, professor at Concordia Seward in Nebraska, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. If you'd like to join us here in our conversation, which has focused here in the first half hour about the proposed parental rights amendment, which is pretty much designed to, institutionalize what we would call the traditional understanding of parenting in America, and protect the institution of parenting in America from outside forces like the United Nations. Jim had an interesting set of comments before we got to the break. Anything that you wanted to react to there, Doctor?
Well, thank you for coming back to his comment, because I thought it was well thought out. The thing that came to my mind is that the government, as in the role of parents as well, are meant to serve for the betterment of society. And as Jim indicated, when government becomes not in a role of service, but of sort of domination or dictation, that should start to cause some alarms to go off. And as Luther would talk about all kinds of vocations and callings and institutions that were established by God, parenting and government were meant to serve for the betterment of the society, not in terms of flexing its muscle or dictating to other groups in society.
Just one other comment on this. This is the head scratcher for me. And maybe I'm just too simple. Maybe I'm just not bright enough. But I just find it to be ironic, maybe even spectacularly so, that the same forces who think that we need to have a child rights amendment or a child rights treaty or something to protect children seem to be pretty much the same people who think it ought to be right and proper to kill a child the day before he or she is to be born.
Mm-hmm.
For thinking, intelligent, educated people, not to see some kind of inconsistency there just blows me away.
Yeah. Yep. That's a great insight, Chuck. I mean, that puts together one of the great great head scratchers, as you said, because it does not make sense. But what it does imply, though, I think, Chuck, is that government knows best. That's the implication there, and maybe that is the way the group that advocates for child's rights come at it, because even parenting, they're too stupid to know best for their own kids, but the government will know what's best, and that becomes a religion or an ideology that sort of trumps any other logic or any other kind of insight, such as you said about the killing of a child before it's born. It just trumps any kind of other kind of logic or peace that would come their way, because government knows best.
I want to take up another topic here. I have an article here authored by Audrey Barrick of the Christian Post, and it seems to me that you might have something to say about this. My impression is that thanks to a considerable amount of content in television and in movies that is pro-homosexual, that America's young people have reached a kind of a comfort level with homosexuality in our culture. I'm wondering if you find that to be true, since you're dealing with 18 to 22-year-olds, more or less, if you think that observation is correct.
I think there's probably a slowing indifference to it, Chuck. And I think that would be the word I would want to stay with, is indifference. Not in a sense of condemning or saying right or wrong, but a sort of a shrug of the shoulders, what are you going to do with it, you know, kind of attitude. I think that is what's a part of the 18 to 22-year-old mindset right now.
The Barna Group yesterday released a new study that explores the faith life of homosexuals compared to heterosexuals. Survey findings indicate that straights are more likely to be committed to their Christian faith than gays, lesbians, and bisexuals. Nearly half, 47% of heterosexual adults qualify as born-again Christians, compared to 27% of homosexuals. Also, 75% of straight adults reported having made a personal commitment to Jesus Christ that is still important in their life today. 58% compared to 75%. 58% of homosexual adults said the same. While 6 out of 10 heterosexuals said they are absolutely committed to the Christian faith, only 4 out of 10 homosexuals expressed such commitment. Moreover, about half of straight adults said their life has been greatly transformed by their faith, while only one-third of homosexual adults agreed. Still, the majority among both heterosexuals, that's 72%, and homosexuals, 60%, said their faith is very important in their life. Majorities in both groups also identified themselves as Christian. George Barna, who heads the Barna Group, said the survey results show that homosexual adults are not the godless, hedonistic Christian bashers that some portray them to be. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think the statistics back up what he has to say about that. One of the things that the media does is it's very good at creating polarization, and in that creating a polarization, it creates stereotypes. And I think what this research does, Chuck, is it presents a more complex, more realistic picture of not only the issue of homosexuality, but also the integration or the incorporation of the faith component in the homosexual issue. You know, again, I wonder if you know the 18 to 22 year olds, in their indifference to this issue, probably realize and understand the best that whether you're homosexual or whether you're heterosexual, there's still a faith there, a faith in Jesus Christ. And maybe that's why there's this indifference to the larger issue of homosexuality, because students say, well, but they still believe in Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. So then the indifference comes in, and then the danger to that, though, is when there becomes indifference, then there becomes a sort of a permission or a sense of allowing it and a sense of it's okay kind of. And that's where the Christian faith would have something to say about that.
As a teacher in God's church, as a college professor, which of the three following possibilities do you think most closely approximates your position?
Okay.
A, we need to move the debate up on homosexuality in the church, and regardless of how difficult or bloody that fight may be, we need to have that fight. Or B, we need to address this at some point, but at the present, there are too many other pressing issues, so let's put it on the back burner. Or C, I am indifferent to it. It's not a central question. It's a personal thing for people of various sexualities to work out for themselves, and I'm not interested in talking about it. Now you're free to pick any other option that you like.
Well, I'm sort of, you know, think. What was A and B again? Say A and B again.
A is let's deal with it right now.
Okay.
Let's go, you know, nose to nose and settle it. B is I don't want to disregard it. I don't want to ignore it, but I don't want to deal with it right now. I'll deal with it later.
Well, I kind of tend to more A, and here's why. Because what's happening in various church bodies today is homosexuality is no longer only the issue of an individual nature, but homosexuality and that issue of sexual identity is guiding church bodies in terms of parenting, of what the family is defined as. It's guiding and you know, showing some kind of direction in terms of are people who are ordained able to carry out their vows of being a pastor or a cleric given their homosexual identity. I don't think it's a question of whether or not we can just ignore it anymore. Anytime the ELCA is now having to grapple this issue publicly as a National Generalized Assembly.
You're talking about the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.
That is correct. We cannot no longer ignore this issue, but we need to handle it in a way respectfully of other church bodies, but also articulating what the scriptures say about homosexuality and how that is viewed by God, because it's not only dealing with the family anymore. It's finding its way into church structure and church polity. So to ignore it is just that's not even an option in my book. But do we raise it at the number one priority level? I'm not sure we do that. But we certainly have to be ready for a response publicly. Anytime it's involving any kind of Lutheran institution, social service-wise, or another Lutheran denomination, we have to be ready for an answer publicly.
Well, here at the ChristianPost.com website, homosexuality is the featured topic of the day. And the headlines, the two headlines that are at the top of the page are: ELCA head calls for prayer amid sexuality debate, because the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America will be meeting in what they call their assembly, I guess.
That's right.
That's in about 7 weeks. And then in the other column, Anglicans officially establish Orthodox body, and that is if I understand this correctly, a number of Anglican parishes who have left the larger Anglican mm-hmm. body here in the United States in order to start a new church body. And I believe that homosexuality and sexual preference is one of the core issues that led to their departure.
That's correct.
So I think for a lot of us, we really do want to stick our heads in the sand here. We want to play the role of the ostrich, and we don't want to talk about it. We don't want to deal with it. But here it is. It's affecting the Lutherans in the ELCA. It's affecting the Anglicans in the now Anglican Church in North America, which was given birth yesterday. And eventually, I think every Christian is going to have to ask and answer this question for him or herself, don't you think?
Well, yeah, and you know, and I think pastors have the opportunity to educate their congregations on this in a way that isn't alarming, but at the same time, pastors can share with their congregation members, say, "Look, children of God, this is a tough issue when we have our own Lutherans." Social agencies here grappling with these issues, can we incorporate them into the ministry as we understand it? Sharing those kind of perspectives with the families of that congregation can be done in a way that allows them a window into the realities that congregations face. And so while they can hear about all the nationwide establishment of churches, it has a direct impact on the local level. And pastors and other workers in the church sharing this with the members can educate them even further and maybe then realize that we can't put the head in the sand anymore.
I am surprised, maybe I'm just naive, I am surprised that this Barna survey shows that the gap between believing heterosexuals and believing homosexuals is only about 20% mm-hmm. in most of these questions. I would have expected it to be larger.
Mm-hmm.
I would have expected that the pronouncements in Scripture as it pertains to homosexual practice, which appear to me to be abundantly clear, would be so troublesome, so problematic for gay advocates that they would not be able to hold the Christian faith and gay advocacy at the same time without mm-hmm. being highly conflicted. But apparently, based on these numbers, 72% of heterosexuals and 60% of homosexuals say their faith is, quote, very important in their life.
That's right.
That's only a 12% difference. I'm kind of surprised by that. Should I be?
Well, I'm not, and because I think there's just a growing indifference, Chuck, to this whole concept of homosexuality and Christianity, and it's not the topic or the issue of homosexuality is sort of getting passed by, and it's kind of pushed to the side. The real issue is, do you believe in Jesus? And so what happens there is, well, okay, homosexuality, fine, but do you believe in Jesus? And that's where that growing indifference, I think, starts to come to the surface then. And so a law gospel message of what it is about homosexuality and the condemning nature of it as God has expressed in his word, and yet the recovering forgiveness that's there for those who repent and confess of their sins, that message does not get communicated. And therefore, if there's an indifference, I'm not surprised by that smallness of difference between heterosexuals and homosexuals.
So, armed with this discussion that we've had here today, it's the summertime, so you're not teaching. But if we were, you know, right in the advance of the fall term,
mm-hmm.
does any of this debate affect you as a teacher? I know that it probably comes up from time to time peripherally in class, but if it is such a central issue, if it affects the Anglicans, if it affects the Lutherans and the ELCA, and we know that it affects all church bodies sooner or later in one way or another, Is it time to tackle the issue head first right there at Concordia Seward?
Well, you certainly put it out in front of them. I'll give you a good example of this. This past spring, when the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America made public what would be, in essence, their decision later this summer about the concept of family, the definition of family, the issue of whether or not a homosexual pastor can be in a committed relationship and still maintain his or her authority as a pastor. When I presented that to the class, again, I'm just kind of reading faces here, there was this sort of, oh, I can't believe we have to deal with this issue. You know, that kind of reaction. And I'm not saying it was a head in the sand kind of reaction, but it was just that, oh.
Just look the other way. You don't have to put your head in the sand to look the other way.
See, and there's a sense of indifference to it, Chuck. There's a sense of, do we really have to deal with this now? It's kind of like when you know, the mom tells the boy to pick up the clothes. Do I have to do it now? You know, and I'll do it sometime, but I just don't want to do it now. That's the kind of reaction I get when you bring up these kinds of issues, and along with parenting, too, as we talked earlier. It's like, do we really have to deal with this? Yes, we have to, because that's the reality. You know, It you know, ultimately after 16 weeks, and of course then it's up to them to take whatever they want from it in terms of, do they want to continue to maintain their interest in this, or do they just want to say, do I have to deal with this now, or can I deal with it 10 years later? 10 years later, it's going to be too late.
Well, I was going to say, it seems like those who were 10 years ago saying, we can deal with this 10 years later, have arrived.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems to me there doesn't seem to be putting it off any longer, anymore. Let's take a call here, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's an open phone, Ask the Pastor program. Hi, Earl, you're on the Bible study.
Hi, I grew up Lutheran, but I now belong to an Anglican church.
Okay.
And my pastor in the Anglican church, who is now in the Diocese of Pittsburgh, his attitude was, yes, homosexuality is a problem in the church, but that's not the real problem. The problem is, do we recognize the theology of the cross or the theology of man's glory? If man's in charge of the church, we're in trouble.
All right. Dr. Mm-hmm. Holtorf, got a comment?
I'm glad the caller brought up that distinction, the theology of the cross. I would only just say that I wouldn't want titles or statements like theology of the cross be sort of cover for showing an indifference to the issue of homosexuality. Does that make sense? I mean, because if it's, well, homosexuality really isn't the issue, it's theology. Okay, that's fine, but we haven't dealt with the issue of homosexuality then, really. Now, we may be able to in the understanding of theology of the cross, certainly, but I would not want to use another theological term or phrase to get us away from the issue that confronts us as a church body.
Is it correct to say that the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah involved homosexual behavior?
It was a part of it. You know, it wasn't the only issue. The issues of economic injustice, a lack of care for those who are in need. I think that needs to be lifted up as well. That it wasn't just homosexuality. It was the total depravity of man being exhibited in those two cities.
Let's take this call before we run out of time here on our Ask the Pastor Hour. Hi, Ray. You're on the Bible study.
How you doing?
I'm doing well.
Good. I prayed for a long time, and I got tired of church hopping, and I ended up a Catholic. And they didn't teach me this. I found this on my own. And it concerns homosexuality. But first of all, it says in Matthew that Jesus says, do not imagine that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have come not to abolish but to complete them. I tell you solemnly, till heaven and earth disappear, not one dot nor one little stroke shall disappear from the law until its purpose is achieved. Now, if you go back to Leviticus, or you can go to Deuteronomy, either one, in Leviticus 18, verse 22, it says, you must not lie with a man as with a woman. This is a hateful thing. Now, this is God's rule. This is God speaking to Moses. He is saying, I am Yahweh, your God.
Okay.
You must keep my laws and my customs.
Let me ask you this, Ray. Did you have a question? Because I got like 2 minutes left here.
Why is there a discussion about homosexuality?
All right. Dr. Holtorf?
Well, it's because it's in front of us as a nation. It's in front of us as a church body. It's in front of many church bodies. What seems to be clear-cut in some people's minds is not in others. And we can't affirm the Word of God in those particular statements, but at the same time, there are those who don't see the authority behind it and have sort of an indifference to it. And I think that's where the churches have to come to some resolve. Are we going to allow God's Word to be God's Word, or are we going to allow man to put his stamp over and say what we want it to say? And that's for the church bodies to decide.
Well, we're pretty much out of time here, and if we had more time, the question I'd like to put to you is, we haven't talked much about heterosexual sin, and there is plenty of that in the church as well.
Right.
But I guess we'll leave that for another day.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Enjoy the summer.
Thank you.
When you get some of that cool Nebraska air, send it our way, if you would.
I'll try what I can.
Dr. Paul Holtorf, he's professor at Concordia University in Seward, and our guest here today on our Ask the Pastor program. Thank you so much for the phone calls. Good phone calls today. And from some folks that we're not used to hearing from all the time. Tomorrow, we will conclude the book of Jude with verses 17 through 25. Pastor Mark Hawkinson will be here. On Thursday, by the way, speaking of Leviticus, as our last caller raised that book, we will begin a study of Leviticus. So I guess eventually we'll be dealing with the question of homosexuality as it appears in the book of Leviticus. And our Ask the Pastor guest tomorrow, a representative from Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis, Dr. Rick Mars, good practical guy here on our Ask the Pastor Bible study. Hope you can join us then.
Listen to Chuck Rather and guests Monday through Friday at the same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of the Bible Study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible Study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.